So I have a clinical background, and I've been a therapist for more than 20 years, but I'm also a survivor of suicide. I lost a sister to suicide in 1987, and so suicide prevention has always been a focus of mine.
This is a dumb question, but what was that like for you?
There's no way to explain it. It's different for everybody, and the amount of pain and suffering that people go through is unimaginable, and it's hard to explain. I will tell you that, let's see, we're 27 years past it, and my parents still haven't recovered. Mm. They never will. It's beyond words, and it's very individual. It's just a pain that always looking to understand, yet there's no way to truly understand.
Is there, even all these years later, is there a sense in your family that, oh, gosh, I could have done something to prevent that?
I think that exists a little bit, but the more I've done this, I realize that this was also an incredible amount of pain and suffering that my sister experienced in her own private world that none of us were able to understand or recognize. We could always sit there and say, well, yeah, they gave this warning sign and this warning sign. And in the end, it doesn't accomplish anything. You know, it's driven my work as the suicide prevention coordinator to be able to maybe help others recognize the signs so that they can intervene. But I think a little bit of that's always going to be there.
What are the warning signs?
We're looking for a change in character. You know, the person didn't usually do this, and now they are. So there's a talk or a theme of death or talking about dying. There is an increase in alcohol or substance use. Perhaps there might be episodes of crying and that type of just clear signs of depression. But then there's also high-risk behavior, whether it's drug use, whether it's sex, whether it's shopping. That can be the kind of a reckless impulsiveness. There's usually changes in sleep patterns or eating patterns, and that can be too much or too little. There is a loss of interest in things that they usually find pleasurable, you know, whether it's something that they used to always love to do, and now they've just, you know, they've dropped off the football team or they dropped out of school. They start to isolate. That's a huge one. They start to pull away from their peer group. They start to pull away from family. They don't communicate as well. One-word answers, or they kind of disappear and just choose to stay by themselves. Those are all just some of the warning signs that we look for.
Mr. Rustin, we're here to talk about the suicide review team, but first maybe let's talk about its reason for being. Montana's suicide rate, I know, is nearly twice the national average. What does that mean in terms of numbers?
It's important to use the term rate because of our sparse population. Our numbers, I mean, if you were comparing us, of course, to a place like Washington or California, it wouldn't seem much. Mm. But we lose somewhere between 225 to 230 people to suicide each year in our state. But that gives us a rate of around 23 per 100,000, and the national average is about 12.
And how do these people most commonly take their own lives?
Well, that varies in different states, of course, based on access to the means. But nationally, about 50% of all suicides are by firearm. But in Montana, that number is about 64-65%.
And is that broken up pretty evenly between men and women, or do women choose a less violent way?
Women tend toward less violent means. A typical profile of someone who attempts would be a woman who overdoses. Typical profile of a completion is a male who uses a firearm. We are seeing an increase, though, in the number of females who do use firearms.
I wonder why.
Just easier access to them, and it's going to be more lethal.
And why do people, most importantly, make this decision? Is it drug, alcohol abuse, isolation, not a lot of money here in Montana? What?
Yes. It's a number of factors. I think it's hard, especially when we take a look at different factors. I mean, if you take a look at the top 10 states for suicide, they're all Rocky Mountain region states, from Alaska right down to Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Idaho. There's a number of factors that play into it, the social isolation, the access to firearms, socioeconomic, alcohol and substance abuse. There's even a correlation with altitude. So there's a number of factors, and some of them play heavier in certain states than other states.
Altitude, now that's I've never heard of.
Yes, yeah, there's been a couple studies that both found a positive correlation with altitude, and one theory is that it's metabolic stress caused by long-term oxygen deprivation. The other theory is that people who live at higher altitudes are more isolated, drink more, and have more guns. So either way, we know that there is a correlation.
And I think anyone who's experienced depression, real depression, not just feeling bummed out, knows that it's a state of hopelessness. There's no optimism, and that's got to play a role.
I'm glad you brought that up, because when we take a look at all the factors that play into our high suicide rate, stigma against mental illness is the biggest. Mm. but we still see depression as a weakness. And if we are depressed, we see ourselves as being a burden. And that stops us from asking for help. And that is one thing that is significantly different than other areas of the country. For instance, I mean, in New York, it's cool to have a therapist. Everybody has a therapist. Well, that's not the case in Montana or the Rocky Mountain region. I see people who are ashamed about having to come to therapy or come to the counseling. And when we start to hide that, that's when we are at the greatest risk. And if I had to say there was an overall goal of a lot of the stuff I do, is that to challenge that stigma and make it okay for us to talk about depression and suicide.
Yeah, but you're asking for a lot.
I am. And that's another important piece, because our rate of suicide has been high for 100 years. It's a cultural issue in our state, and it's going to take a cultural shift in thinking. And I'm very, very aware that that is going to be a slow process that will take generations to do.
Is this country focused enough on our mental health needs?
No, I think, although we talk about the stigma being the greatest in the Rocky Mountain region, that stigma exists elsewhere. We've attached a shame or a fear with mental illness that we wouldn't do with cancer or diabetes. And yet we're talking about many times that we are talking about a biologically based illness that can be treated if we bring it to our awareness and ask for help.
But there's still so much about brain disease that we don't understand.
Oh, incredible amounts. And we're learning more and more about it, but it's a slow process. We're very limited in the amount of what we know actually about how the brain operates.
Mr. Rustin, and then there are these cases of the sort that recently affected Butte, where at least three school students took their own lives within 6 weeks. What goes through your mind when you see that unbelievable phenomenon?
Well, there's a great deal of sorrow for the pain that the community is feeling. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon. It seems every few months we have a community where there is an epidemic of suicides. It's reaching out to those communities and trying to get them the awareness. Unfortunately, many times the awareness isn't raised after one suicide. It's usually two or three. And it always raises attention when a child makes that decision that they'd rather be dead than deal with what they're dealing with.
Why that grouping, though? That's what I don't get.
Well, a lot of times there's a fear around, you know, it's kind of like that threshold of where they don't know what to do with their pain, and there are lots of ideas come in. And many times, especially with kids, there's an impulsiveness that goes with suicide. We know from the research that almost a third of all youth suicides occur within the first hour of having the first thought. So many times it's an act of impulse. And so when you have one child that does it, it brings down that threshold and all of a sudden makes it more accessible or somehow okay.
But back up, what was that stat, the first hour, first thought?
Say? About, with adolescents and young people, about 30% of those suicides occur within the first hour of having the first thought. Now, it becomes less of an active impulse as we get to middle age and elderly, but definitely with our young. And they're known for doing things without thinking. It's kind of part of the development.
Tell us about this suicide review team.
Yes, we understand the national numbers, and we know the national research. But in the 6 years that I've had this position, what I have found is things that were developed back east don't apply to Montana. I think the governor's goal in creating this team was for us to take a close look at why we are losing so many people and to see if there's some factors that we're missing, to better understand the process and the dynamics and the relationships and the underlying issues. Because when we start to do that, then we can start to earmark prevention efforts to that population. And I'm even hoping that as we start to take a look and really gather just large amounts of data and be able to interpret and investigate into it, maybe we can find issues that are a community-based issue so that we can really focus our prevention efforts on those communities that need the help.
How will you all be doing this, and how many suicides do you predict you'll be investigating?
Our goal is to be able to look at all of them in some way, and then we will be picking or choosing certain ones to do as close to what we can call a psychological autopsy, and that is to really take a look at the history. But the way we have it set up, or we're hoping to have it set up, is when a suicide occurs, for us to work closely with coroners around the state to get the information, the death certificate, as soon as possible and get all of their notes and everything. and then for us to ask questions and get as much help as we can from them, and then through that process to be able to maybe talk with a family physician about if there is a history or if there's health issues, mental health issues, that type of thing. Work with mental health providers and understanding what the sequence of events that might have been had led up to this, because then our hope is that if we can understand that, then we can start to provide some prevention and intervention.
Gosh, it sounds like dark work.
It is. Then it's going to be a very daunting task. And I imagine that we're going to run into barriers. That's even part of the process. We have to understand the barriers and as a group and as a state, take a look at how we can overcome those barriers.
I guess maybe to wrap up, you're not some guy who's been to a seminar and thinks he knows it all about this issue. You've lived it.
I've lived it, and I have a lot of experience in it, and I'm still not an expert. This is a constant evolution of growth, and there's plenty of things I might know, but there's a lot more that I don't. It's a constant growth process.
Maybe, just maybe, somewhere out there in the audience, there is a man or a woman who has been rolling around this thought, taking his or her own life. If you could sit this person down, what would you tell this person?
Well, I always want to be careful because I'm not trying to guilt trip them. The biggest thing I would say is there's hope. The pain doesn't last. And that's one of the things that happens. There's a sense of hopelessness and helplessness that the person feels. And quickly they start to think it's always going to be this way. Nothing's ever going to change. And that's the piece that people have to understand. Nothing is forever except death and taxes. So the pain that they're suffering and they're experiencing, we know from the research that most of the time when a person hits suicide crisis, we're talking about a 72-hour window of when the pain is the most intense, and then it tends to subside. Now, it might come back, but it doesn't always stay at that level. And especially with depression, if treated, depression is one of the most treatable of all psychiatric disorders, if talked about.
Depression, though, is also one of the most consuming, terrible feelings to experience.
Yes.
And I know.
It is. It's overwhelming. It is all-consuming. It changes how you see the world.
It does. Mr. Carl Rosten, Montana Suicide Prevention Coordinator. Boy, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Best of luck to you and your team.
Thank you very much.